Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Hello everyone, it's Nick Peters here with the Deeper Waters Podcast. We are going to be having our regular show this Saturday with Rob Bowman on to talk about the Trinity, but today we're having a special Easter interview with Dr. Gary Habermas, who's graciously agreed to give us a half hour of his time. This won't be a live show, so we won't be taking your calls today, but Dr. Gary Habermas, are you there?
I am here, Nick. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you again. Now, before we start talking about the subject, for my listeners who might not know who you are, tell us a little bit about who you are and why exactly my listeners should take your view on this seriously.
I don't twist any arms, but here's a little bit about my background. Many, many years ago, I spent 10 years questioning the Christian faith. I mean, a lot of people say that they never did more than ask questions. I came very close to leaving the faith. In fact, there are times when I wonder if I really did for a while. But my doubts centered on the subject of the resurrection of Jesus. And I became convinced that the resurrection was the center of Christianity, and therefore the value of resurrection study would be tremendous. And so I jumped into it with both feet, and I reached a place, an impasse, where I thought I couldn't demonstrate the resurrection, and so I let it go. I thought, well, this can be believed in, but it can't be shown to be true. And I returned to it years later when I was writing my doctoral dissertation at a secular school. And this time it made sense. I finished the research. And since then I've written quite a few books on the resurrection, including debates and things like that. And the resurrection is my favorite topic in the world, both for factual and also for existential reasons.
Okay. Well, we're going to jump right into the subject matter. First, I'm going to read a short little passage of Scripture here for you.
Sure.
I'm reading from 1 Corinthians 15. Now, brothers and sisters, I want to remind you of the gospel I preached to you, which you received and on which you have taken your stand. By this gospel you are saved, if you hold firmly to the word I preached to you. Otherwise you have believed in vain. For what I received I passed on to you as of first importance, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas and then to the 12. After that, he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers and sisters at the same time, most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles, and last of all, he appeared to me also, as to one abnormally born. Now, Dr. Habermas, in this passage, many of us in our churches will go and just read this passage and think, oh, this is kind of, you know, your regular nice little passage and such. But according to you, there is something much bigger going on in this passage. Would you care to explain it?
Well, sure. I think there's a lot of things going on. I mean, you could literally write a doctoral dissertation on this text alone. But in apologetics, we ask over and over again, how do we know that the New Testament can be trusted? How do we know that our sources are good? How do you know that they're early? How do you know that they're from eyewitnesses? Did they really believe what they said? And on and on and on. And one of the first principles of research is to study people who are in the right place at the right time to pick the right material here. I mean, the question would be the same if I were to ask you, the method would be the same. If I were to say, how do we know George Washington's the first president of the United States? You'd eventually want to get to some sources that would be, wonderful to find some that that knew him when he was president, and so on. Now, people can misrepresent truth and so on, so you have to ask other alternative questions. But Paul is saying in that passage, verse 3 that you read, I gave you what I was given. And we read from Josephus and other sources that that's what Pharisees did. They were good researchers. They checked out material with other people. And so when Paul is saying, I'm interested in this. This is the center of the faith. And so I went to some other people and asked these questions. He's going, as we have this little phrase, going to the horse's mouth. He's checking it out firsthand. In fact, he says that's what he does in Galatians chapter 1. He says he checks it out. But he says he's going to people who were authoritative before he came on the scene. And most scholars think that he came on the scene only about 2 years after the crucifixion, as far as his appearance from Jesus. So he's already early, but he's going back earlier to those who had the material before he did.
Okay. But also, isn't this material right? He's talking about, I've heard you say this is not original with Paul.
Right.
Paul didn't make up this material. How do you know that, and can you demonstrate it?
Yeah, there are anywhere, depending on how you count, there are between a half dozen and maybe as many as 10 indications that this material is not his. Probably the strongest argument is the fact that Paul is the critic's darling. They think that of all the New Testament writers, Paul is the one that we can be sure was the writer of at least the major books that bear his name. Critical scholars now, not people who just go off on any reason, but critical scholars will always allow books like 1 Corinthians and Galatians as sources that Paul wrote. They'll allow Paul as a scholar. And what that means is, even if they're skeptics, it doesn't mean Paul's right about all his beliefs. It just means Paul's authoritative. He was in the right place, right time, was honest, wouldn't knowingly lie. He was a good researcher, and so on. And so Paul says, I gave you what I was given. He's either being truthful or he isn't. And, I mean, it basically comes down to that. And Paul is telling us that he got this from somebody else. So given the fact that a trustworthy source said, I got this from somebody else, and it's not a very strange claim, Bill wasn't there that night. I went and talked to him myself, that kind of thing. It's a straightforward claim. And so the main reason is Paul just said, I got this from somebody else. But as far as the indications, there are several words in this passage. Is a very brief passage. There are several phrases and words that Paul never uses anywhere else in his writings. It appears in a staccato kind of in the original, and it may be from Aramaic, which is another indication. And he uses the Aramaic name for Peter, Cephas, which is often an indication of the text is earlier. But in the Greek, it's more like this. It doesn't rhyme like English, but it's more like this. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Dot, 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 dot. It's in a couple stanzas, and so it comes across as something that's stylized and formalized and passed down. So there's a few reasons right there.
Okay, now we are told regularly that 1 Corinthians, while authentically Pauline, dates to the mid-50s.
Right.
But this creedal material, it's verses 3 through 7, it dates much earlier. What date is given to this creedal material?
Well, I have heard in more than one place. I mean, Richard Baucom, for example, in his book Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, a prominent New Testament scholar, Baucom, that is, quotes a scholar who says that the consensus New Testament position is that Paul received this material about 5 years after the crucifixion of Jesus. So for those who date the crucifixion of 30 A.D., he would be receiving this material about 35. And that's not just a guess. You can do the math. If Paul's trip to Damascus is at about plus 2, i.e. 2 years after the cross, then he says in Galatians 1:18 that 3 years later he went up to Jerusalem and talked to the apostles. 2 plus 3 is 5. So it's thought that about 5 years after the cross, Paul got this material. Now, I remind your listeners, Nick, that this That's when Paul heard the material. They had it before he did. After all, I gave you what I have given. And this was passed down in that da-da-da-da-da-da-da staccato. So, I mean, it takes a while to get this down formally. It would be like saying, do you want to write a song and then do you want to put some music to it? It takes a while to get these things in order. But 5 years takes us right back to, for the actual report, back even a lot earlier. And Bart Ehrman, the famous, probably the best-known skeptic in America today, Bart Ehrman says that this material goes back, not the events, but the material reporting the events goes back to 1 to 2 years after the cross.
Okay. Are there any other non-Christian scholars that will date this, or is Bart Ehrman just alone stand out?
Well, there are some skeptic, very, very skeptical people. Garrett Ludeman, for example, who's sometimes called an atheist New Testament scholar. I don't really know what his personal beliefs are, but I mean, I've heard him called that regularly. He's quite skeptical. Garrett Ludeman says the latest, not for the date of the material, but for the latest that Paul could have gotten it, is 3 years after the cross. And then, of course, you got to back up. If he got it from Peter and James 3 years after the cross, well, then Peter and James had it before he did, and then the formalizing the creed is earlier still. So if he, in fact, is an atheist, at least he's a very skeptical New Testament scholar. Yeah, he puts it in that same time frame. The reception of it, he actually puts, it looks like he puts it earlier than Bart Ehrman. Just a few other well-known scholars. James D.G. Dunn says that you can date this material, the formalization of it, just a few months after the events themselves, a few months after the crucifixion. And and Larry Hurtado, same thing, that early Christian preaching began with preaching on a high view of Jesus, that Jesus was worshipped, and that he was raised from the dead, that there was no Christian preaching without that. So it was there right from the beginning. So there's some people, Gerald O'Collins is another one, mm-hmm. scholars who put it right back there at the beginning. So it's definitely early. I mean, when you talk about our earliest sources for Alexander being hundreds of years later, Alexander the Great, and the best sources for Alexander being 4 1/4 to 450, namely Plutarch and Arrian, and when you talk about the sources for Buddha being hundreds of years after Buddha lived, and Buddha scholars saying we don't have them any earlier than that, and someone says 1 to 2 years for the center of Christianity, the deity, death, resurrection of Jesus. I mean, that's just, it's just unfathomable that you could think that our basis for our faith is that firm.
Okay. Let's take the worst case scenario then of 5 years after the event is when this creed was formulated. I'm not saying that's the case, but we're going to take the worst case scenario.
Okay, but not formulated when Paul received it.
Yeah.
This clause
okay.
Five. Okay.
What does this demonstrate about the resurrection? Can this show the resurrection happened?
Okay, what you get out of this is there were people walking around from the time of the crucifixion until 5 years afterwards, because Paul got this from others who themselves mm-hmm. had to take time to make this creed up. During that 5 years, you've got literally what you have is people walking around saying, we saw Jesus both singly and in groups, individually and in groups. They're saying that. Now, just the fact that someone says something doesn't make it true. Doesn't mean it's true.
Yeah.
So you've got to wade in there and see if those comments are true. But what you have are sincere people, proved their sincerity proved by the fact that they were willing to die for it. Now, we have a lot of people today who are willing to die for a lot of things. But one thing for sure, willing to die for something means you're convinced it's true. You could be wrong, but you're convinced it's true. And so, yes, I mean, from the viewpoint that people were willing to die, and we have first century sources for their martyrdoms, like Peter, Paul, and James, the brother of Jesus, that means they were preaching it from the beginning, very early date. They said, I was a witness. So what you have there are very, very, very early eyewitnesses, independent sources, and you have people who are being honest about it, as indicated by the fact that they were willing to die for what they proclaimed. So you're starting to get a pretty good case here together.
Okay. But, a lot of skeptics will look at this passage and say, well, there's a claim of 500 eyewitnesses. And they say, I've got two problems with that. First off, mass hallucination, just like when people see Mary and such. And second off, there's no names given of these 500. How could people find out who they are?
Oh, good point. But I suppose, let me take the second one first, just a little more straightforward answer. You say we don't know the names of them. First of all, Paul says he appeared to 500 of the brothers, and you could check it out, they're still around. So I guess what Paul might say is, and don't forget, Paul's citing something that he didn't originate. So
yeah.
The original person, he's citing them. And Paul might just say, hey, do what I did. Go back to Palestine, and they'll introduce you to these people. But it's not true that there are no people mentioned. I mean, there are individuals associated with this. Paul himself is a skeptic and a persecutor, a skeptical Christianity. And he persecuted those who named the name of Christ. James, the brother of Jesus, was an unbeliever, as far as we know, until he met the risen Jesus. So names are mentioned. There are names of the apostles mentioned. Now, I mean, the person is going to start saying, yeah, but they were believers. But you can't say that about Paul, and you can't say that about James. And plus, you've got your normal kind of skepticism that anybody says. I mean, for example, the book of John, which is maligned by some, but John actually reports less miracles than the other gospel. But in John chapter 12, a voice comes from heaven and says, this is my son. And people standing there say, wow, it just thundered. I mean, that tells you that people in that day were capable of asking tough questions too. So you'd have to do your research and check these things out.
Okay.
Oh, but that's your second question.
Yeah.
Your first question, I would put the burden on you. I would say, Nick, you've said there are group hallucinations, and you've mentioned a case, Marian apparitions. What makes you think, or how can you prove, that Marian apparitions are mass hallucinations?
Yeah.
How could you do that?
Well, you know, some people would say, well, these are, they introduce doctrines that we disagree with. At times. If you're a Protestant, it definitely does.
But does that mean that they didn't see something?
No, I mean, a Protestant could just swear, say, they saw a demonic image show up.
Well, I mean, okay. Now, but if we have to be real careful here for more than one reason. Let's say it's a demonic image. Someone says, oh, well, you saw a demon. All right. Unfortunately for the skeptics, unfortunately for the naturalists, they're not going to go there because if these are angels or demons or spiritual beings of some sort, now we have a spiritual world. We have a real world in which we walk and talk and see things, and we have a world of the unseen in which there are creatures and beings and, you know, a spiritual world that could very well be a heaven. I don't think they're going to go there. But okay, so you say, well, Protestants might go there because that's not to me, that's a secondary question. We'd have to decide the religious question. I'm just saying, how do you know that these are hallucinations? It sounds to me like it's an assumption. You know, sort of like these must be hallucinations because I don't like the message. And interestingly enough, that sounds a little to me what the skeptics of the resurrection are doing. This must be an hallucination because you kind of pushed me in a corner and you said people saw the risen Jesus, and I don't want to say it's anybody. I don't want to say it's Jesus, so I'll say it's anything. I'll say, you know, anything at all. Back to Mary for a minute. One clarification. The groups of people who go to these events, they don't see Mary. The people in the groups don't see Mary. They watch children who say they're talking with Mary, and not all the children see 24/7. I mean, let's put it this way. If I went to an event and there were 3,000 people present, and they said, we want to see these wonderful events. Where's Mary? And 99.9% of the people present don't see Mary. I would start asking some questions about what's going on here when most of them don't. Now, let's look at the flip over to the Gospels or to the list of appearances of 1 Corinthians 15. And, you know, as far as we know, everybody who's present sees Jesus. The only exception that I'm aware of are Paul's companions on the way to Damascus, and Paul says that's not a normal appearance. The word there in the Greek is for aborted or miscarried. I'm somebody after the normal time sequence. And secondly, these people did hear voices, hear noises. You know, the people who were with Paul, they fell to the ground. They responded. They saw the light, so they saw things. But that's the closest, and it's not one of the mainline resurrection appearances before Jesus ascended. So we don't really have, what if we had a case where 99% of the people present didn't see Jesus? I think skeptics would say, yeah, they'd say, yeah, let's go after this. That's great, but that's not what we have.
Okay, we're looking at Paul right quick. And Paul describes this as a vision. So maybe what Paul had was an individual hallucination. I mean, what do we think about people today who have visions, for instance?
Where does Paul say it's a vision? Yeah.
That's a good question. That's what's usually said, though.
What's that?
That's a good question. But he doesn't say that anywhere, does he?
No, he doesn't say that. He uses the word opte. It's the Greek word for see. It comes from the root word horao, and it could be, refer to something like, Nick, I see what you're talking about there. You could use that word for non-visual sight. I see what you're talking about. But the word is actually used in the Greek. It's actually used more often for physical sight than non-physical sight. I'm saying, could it be non-physical? Well, if you want to push it. What's your evidence for that? Don't have any. So that's kind of a short conversation. It's used more often for physical sight. In fact, this will get you. Paul says, he's using the root word, harao. Jesus appeared to all these people. That's the same word, Nick, the same Greek root word that Luke uses in Luke when he says, handle me and see, for a spirit has not flesh and bones as you see me have. And he says, handle me, and he says, give me some fish, and give me something to eat, and so on. Same word.
Interesting.
So I don't think that's getting us too far.
Okay. Now, the skeptical objection, of course, will also be about miracles.
Right.
We know miracles don't happen, and miracles only happen in these ancient times when people were gullible and believed all this stuff. Today, we know better through the eyes of science. Your response?
Well, I mean, like, how long do we have? The issue is that there are all kinds of measurable, observable phenomena today that give evidence of a supernatural world. Now, I'm just going to list a few of these things. But if the person says, well, I don't believe in a God, all right, well, let's talk about arguments for God. If someone says, yeah, but this is a miracle, I don't believe in the evidence for miracles, I'd say, well, get a hold of Craig Keener's two-volume work entitled, appropriately, Miracles. And there are thousands of modern accounts of miracles from around the world. Mm-hmm. And if you say, well, that happens among ignorant and people who, you know, people who haven't gone to school, well, then look at the chapters on miracle, recent miracle claims in Western Europe, North America, U.S., and look at the ones with medical evidence before and after things. There's a number of them. So, and someone says, well, you're talking about an afterlife with the resurrection of Jesus. There's no afterlife. I could say, well, let's talk about near-death experiences.
Yeah.
And once again, you'd be behind the eight ball. So if you want to talk about God, if you want to talk about miracles, you want to talk about afterlife, all of which the realm in which the resurrection occurs, I'd say if what you want's evidence, let's talk, because I think the person's going to lose at all these avenues. So if the idea is these things don't happen, it sounds to me that that's a very carefully or not so carefully concocted mythology, let's say, on their part. Because they're just assuming that their worldview is true. I'd like to start saying to them, all right, enough about me, enough about God, miracles, resurrection, and afterlife. Why don't you prove to me that your naturalism is true?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're getting pretty close to the end of that conversation. I don't think there's proof for naturalism.
Yeah.
In fact, there's not even any good evidence for naturalism. Naturalism is a mindset. It's a worldview. Yeah. It's not proven. You don't prove the lack of evidence for something.
Yeah. For those interested in my audience, I am working on trying to get Craig Keener to come on the program sometime to talk about
move.
This.
Good move.
Speaking about, I think one you'd recommend on this topic for your listeners would be The Case of the Resurrection of Jesus.
Yeah, that book with Michael Cohen and I, it was written for a popular audience. If somebody wants to see it listed in just a little under 400 pages, but if that sounds like a lot of reading to you, there's in the neighborhood of about 100 pages of endnotes. I hate to say it this way because I hope people will read it, but they don't have to read the endnotes. So that'll cut down a lot of the reading. There's large print. There's a lot of diagrams. It it walks you through the whole thing and tells you how to study the resurrection, how to personally assimilate it, and how to be able to tell others about it.
And there's a game with it.
There is a DVD that you can kind of take it and see if you're a resurrection master, so to speak. See if you can answer these tough questions and be proclaimed one of the resurrection experts.
Yeah, and I'll go ahead and admit my bias so skeptics won't go crazy that Mike Lacona actually is my father-in-law, and I think you had a little hand to do with that also, Gary.
And, I did. Mike was a student of mine, and not in class, actually, but I directed his master's thesis. Mm-hmm. And, of course, our families have been very, very close, and we spent a lot of time talking. So Mike and I have been around the block with each other over the years with our questions back and forth and chatting about debates and whatnot.
Yep. So now we've talked about the resurrection. For now, I'm just going to assume it's a fact. There are several more questions that we could ask, but I'm going to assume it's true. So Okay. Now, what difference does it make?
My answer to that, I mean, I could do it in one word. I would say everything. It makes all the difference in the world. Now, Paul takes specific time with it after going through the most evidential passage in anywhere on the resurrection, namely the one you read, 1 Corinthians 15, 1 and following. About a dozen verses into it, he says in verse 12, he starts saying, if Christ has not been raised, all of us witnesses are false, we're liars, we're false proclaimers. Now, by the way, who's the we there? When you go back one verse to verse 11, the we is the apostles who saw Jesus. So Paul's talking about all of them. Verse 11 is a very important verse. 1 Corinthians 15:11 says, whether it's I or they, this is what we teach and this is what you believe. So what Paul's saying is, I don't care, don't take my word for it, fine. Go talk to Peter, go talk to James. Talk to these fellas, and you're going to hear the same message. So there's strength in numbers. Two heads are better than one. We have names for these things. So Paul says we're not false witnesses. We would be if we were false.
Yeah.
But go back and check it out. It's true. And then he says, if Christ has not been raised, your sins are not forgiven. Well, that makes sense. And he says your loved ones who've died in Christ have died in vain. He says that, that you think about that. He says in 1 Thessalonians, we sorrow when our loved ones die. We sorrow, but not as those without hope. Sorrowing with hope and sorrowing without hope are very different things. And the resurrection tells us that life goes on, that there's an afterlife. And so we sorrow when we lose somebody, but with the knowledge that we will be reunited with believers. I couldn't think of anything more precious. Hmm. And Nick, you know that in 1995, my wife, Debbie, died. Now, I'm married. I'm remarried again. But in 95, my wife, Debbie, at that time, died of stomach cancer. And I couldn't imagine anything more painful. I told my closest friends the worst possible thing has come upon me. Mm-hmm. Bottom line, what the resurrection means to me is, not just does it show that Jesus is the Son of God, what he taught was true, the Christian Gospels, the deity, death, resurrection of Jesus, so the center of Christianity is true, but it means that we'll be united with our friends and loved ones forever. I mean, how's that for a definition of heaven? Fellowship with our believing friends and loved ones forever with the God of the universe. I mean, does it get any better than that? Now, somebody responds and says, well, yeah, in your dreams, or yeah, in mythology, and I'd say, it's hardly mythology when you have evidence for A, God, B, miracles, C, a resurrection, and D, an afterlife. I mean, it's looking to me like this worldview is coming together pretty well. And and I think this is the most exciting time in history to be alive because of the kind of data we have and the truth we have for this. And we know there's a hope. It's not the kind of you know, keep my fingers crossed and I'll see you someday. I mean, yeah. For people who are saying you guys never talk about evidence, you always talk about faith, I'm not trying to sound cocky, but I'd say, well, then, I mean, come up with a good answer. Don't disbelieve because you're angry, or don't disbelieve because some Christian mistreated you. I mean, that happens often enough to all of us. But what do we do with the data?
Yeah. Now, you've only been able to give us half an hour, so we're coming close to that time. So for my listeners out there who want to know more about what you have for them, because we've only been able to touch the surface here.
Sure.
What can they
sure.
do?
Well, a good, great question. I think, Nick, the best thing I could send them to is my website, and I'll put my heart into this. There's nothing for sale on my website, so I'm not asking anybody to buy anything, and I've not asked you to push one of my books or anything. I'm just not that kind of person.
That was all me who did
stuff. That. I'm sorry?
That was all me who suggested the book.
Yeah, I didn't ask you to do that. I do appreciate you doing it, but to me, the website, GaryHabermas.com, H-A-B-E-R-M-A-S, GaryHabermas.com, it has a bunch of material on all these topics. It's got a lot of thoughts in particular on miracle, on resurrection, on afterlife, and some things on God, some things on atheism. All over the website, nothing is for sale. So if it's edifying, if it can be used, if it can be taken, if it can be employed to speak to others, I think it's great. I'm not making a penny off of it. It's there for other people. I'm glad it's being put to good use.
Now, if they did want to buy your books, though, several of them are for sale in places like Amazon and pretty much anywhere you could buy books. And you've even got some books for free on your website.
Ah, as a matter of fact, yes, that's a good point. Under the books tab on the left-hand side, there are I've written three books on doubt. Two of the three are there on the website, The Thomas Factor, Using Your Doubts to Grow Closer to God, and a book called Dealing with Doubt. They're both on the website. They could be used for questioners. And I also have chapters from some of my other books. Got a couple chapters on historical Jesus. I've got a couple chapters from the book on grief when my wife passed away.
Yeah.
They're on my website, and people can hopefully read and enjoy.
Okay. Well, before we go, we've got Easter coming up. So any message out there to my listeners for Easter, for things they can do on Easter, or how they should think on Easter, things of that sort?
Nick, to me, it's the greatest day of the year. At least with Easter, we know we're very close to the events. Christmas, we know we're not close to them. We don't know the time of the year when Jesus died. The time of the year when Jesus was born. But we do know the time he died and was raised from the dead, and we're pretty close. We know it was spring because of Passover and so on, and we're very close to it. So I think what would be in order would be meditation on the person of Jesus, meditation on God and his promises, meditation on what we can to our lives. To me, that would make this a wonderful Easter. And also to think about our own commitment level and our commitment to the God of the universe, who the Son Jesus from the dead.
Yeah, we've been talking about that here lately, with discussing how we can grow in discipleship in Peter's household here. So, Easter is a great time to be doing that.
It is, man. It is wonderful.
Thank you very much for being our guest for this little time, Dr. Habermas, and I hope we'll be seeing you again.
Thank you. It was a good interview. Excellent questions. I appreciate your research. I appreciate you asking questions that allow good answers. Had a good time with you.
And I appreciate your research as well, all the work you've done, your friendship, and considering other things I mentioned, there are some other things I think, I appreciate you for greatly.
Thank you, Nick. Enjoy the weekend.
You too. Happy Easter.
Happy Easter to you too. He's risen.
He is risen indeed.
Indeed.
Well, that's been our interview with Gary Habermas, Uninterrupted. I'd like to remind everyone here that Dr. Habermas does give out his material for free, and we give out ours for free as well, but we do encourage you to support us, especially support the ministry of Deeper Waters, too. And you can find me at deeperwaters.wordpress.com, and my research is there as well. And yes, you can take whatever you want from there. Just let me know it when you share. Just say it's from me, and do try to make a donation to us. We definitely appreciate it. And if you want to know how to donate to Blog Talk Radio, where here's Vitz.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gift if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
And this has been our special Easter episode of Deeper Waters. I'm Nick Peters, signing off.